All right. So I felt like we could get going, and then maybe at the end, maybe do some brainstorming about some future episodes, like Star Wars and Marvel and stuff like that.
Yeah. Challenge accepted, Josh Wilson. I don't know. It's
get back to the fun stuff. I feel like we've been so serious these last few episodes.
Yeah, and two, especially what we're doing today, I feel like, right? For real.
Well, Thurman's still depressed.
Oh, man. You know, let's start off talking about that, because I paid, but watching both of those films, so I watched them both in the last couple of days, and it was an emotional roller coaster, for sure. Like, but each one in different ways. Like, Glory was very inspirational, you know. Like, I did kind of like semi-tear up maybe 4 or 5 times. But like, 12 Years a Slave was a totally different emotional response. Like, it was like, and at the very end, it's like an overload. Honestly, that's what it was like for me. But man, both of those movies were very, very depressing. Man.
Right. I think yeah, that's a good way to really sum it up. Yeah, they're very emotional films, very 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 emotional films, and it's kind of interesting thinking like what are our connections between these films, and of course what we're studying, which is the Lost Cause myth. And you know, I think that these are stories that absolutely need to be told, and that. Like things like the Lost Cause myth really eclipse these stories. They delegate them to being side stories instead of being main attractions, which they should have been all along in this whole historical narrative.
Yeah, I totally get that. And it too, I think this is a very good compliment to like the thread that we've been building on with the Lost Cause, just because just through Arkansas history, have been and done a lot of research this past semester. I've been talking to Dr. Jones, having her on the podcast. It was nice because one thing when we talked about Gods and Generals in Gettysburg, more so Gettysburg, but like how just a lot of times in the Lost Cause, the people of color are absent, right? They're just absent. Or they're these happy participants, like, you know, and that's, it was a nice switch up to say like, okay, what was this like from these people who just wanted to be soldiers, like in Glory, like all this, the base level soldier stuff is like a literal act of Congress in that film. Like, hey, we just would like some shoes, just some shoes to march in. You know, but like, it was nice to get that perspective from both sides. Like, I really want to research now how big of a thing kidnapping was. Right? Like, do either of you know anything about that?
Of course, that's one of the things that's left out of Gettysburg, is the fact that once Lee had invaded up into Pennsylvania, is that the Confederacy were shipping Black Americans back down south to be sold back into slavery. And of course that's left out of that. And I mean, I think that's interesting too, in terms of 12 Years a Slave. I mean, you know, how often do we hear these horror stories about free Black men or women being transported back south to be sold back into slavery, you know, when there's no legal right for that or human right? But that's a story you don't hear. Most of the time you hear it right the other way around with the Underground Railroad. We're trying to smuggle people out of the South into the North. You don't hear these horror stories, like I said, about free people being dragged back into chains. You don't hear about that. And I definitely think that's a story that needs to be told.
I did some research on the book, 12 Years a Slave. I actually purchased it, but then FedEx lost it in the mail, so I didn't get to read it. So I had to do a lot of background research on it. And yeah, it is the most well-known story of someone who was kidnapped during that time period and then put into slavery. But it was interesting to me, like the 12 Years a Slave, the novel or memoir, whatever you want to call it, was like a big part of the abolitionist movement, a huge in abolitionist literature, but then just kind of fell off afterwards and went into obscurity until it came back, I want to say around the 60s, maybe with civil rights movement. But yeah, I've read several articles on it, and you know, there were a lot of university professors that actually researched 12 Years a Slave and were able to prove, like, yes, this actually did happen. We, you know, have the documents of him being sold and all these other things. But it's just crazy to me that this book, like, isn't, you know, required reading or anything, because you are right, like, this is an important story. And it's a story that often gets sidelined, you know, in favor of this kind of nostalgic, rose-colored glasses look back at the Civil War and at how great the South was during the plantation times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Great points. I mean, I absolutely agree with that. I think that's what's interesting, right, is the rise of this book back in the 1960s. Because you're right, it does. It falls off the map. Nobody really talks about it in a roughly 100-year period or whatever. And I mean, I think it's interesting too that Solomon Northrup, right, the guy who wrote the book and all that, and 12 Years a Slave, that I mean, they don't even know what happened to him, right? I mean, they don't know where he's buried. They don't know how he died or anything like that. I think that's kind of fascinating. You know, the guy told his story and then that was pretty much it. But that the rise of in the 60s, what's important is that, right, the civil rights movement, the connection with that, you get into African-American studies, you get into the rise of what is sometimes referred to as new history, which sort of went against this older model, which was, instead of looking at things from the top up, like great figures, great men, you know, stuff like that, we're looking more at the bottom, more from the bottom up, which I think is kind of where these films come in too, because it was like, I mean, Solomon Northrup was just, he was a free black man, right? I mean, he wasn't, I mean, you know, he was somebody, but he wasn't like an Abraham Lincoln type or a president or somebody like that. And Glory, for instance, is just, right, they're foot soldiers, they're infantry, the 54th Massachusetts Colored Infantry, right? So I think that's interesting that, right, you get history from the bottom up instead of from the top down, which I feel like in a lot of ways, the lost cause is that old model where you have top down, guys like Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, Jefferson Davis, you know, and it doesn't focus on the real people. It's about gigantic personas instead of about the everyday figures who actually really existed.
The thing that's like crazy to me is, you know, looking at the other movies we've watched, and we talked a lot about historical accuracy and inaccuracy, I would say like Glory, I mean, does take some liberties, but it's mostly storytelling choices. And 12 Years a Slave seems pretty historically accurate. And that to me, both of these stories are like, I mean, crazy stories. Like if you just watched it and didn't know anything about Civil War, about slavery, you would think that they had made up a lot of this for the sake of the story. But for the most part, a lot of it is pretty accurate. Meanwhile, these other movies and stories that focus on the lost cause are just, I mean, pure fiction. Pretty much everything is made up or painted in a light to make it look better, look different from how it actually was.
Right.
Thurman, I always love doing these because I'm going to look up a ton of stuff after, as I'm watching the film or having had these conversations. But is that order in Glory that they read to the troops and then also to the officers, like, hey, if any soldier is caught, they're going to be executed. If any white officer commanding a unit is captured, they're going to be. Have you seen a primary source on that? I'm not, I totally assumed that it was a real order, but that was something I wanted to go look up that I have not looked up. Have you seen or know anything about that, either of you?
I don't recall having actually seen a primary source for it. I've heard it from other places before, but I've never seen anything. I mean, I'm not doubting it exists because atrocities did happen between captured African-American troops and, you know, captured by the Confederates. The Fort Pillow Massacre is a primary example of that, in which nearly three...
In Arkansas as well. There was a Black regiment massacred.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, like, I've not seen anything specific about it, but it's one of those things where I almost, you know, don't doubt that it probably did exist.
Yeah, Fort Pillow and Poison Spring are the two that I talk about in my U.S. class. I talk about just, I even mentioned both of them in Arkansas as well. But that does put an interesting context. You know how, like, things like Elaine or these, like, okay, are they a massacre or are they a battle, right? Because, like, I mean, I guess you could say from the Confederate point of view, like, if that's their following orders type of a thing, right? And yes, it's wartime and very, very terrible. But if you, like, if you put that as a comparison over Sherman's March to the Sea, you know, or the guerrilla activity as a whole in any theater, but particularly in Arkansas, you know, it's, there are all these dynamics to the Civil War that are fascinating, you know, that...
Well, I don't...
Go ahead.
Oh, I don't think there's an example during Sherman's March of 300 soldiers surrendering and then being killed. You know, I don't think that in terrible ways, I don't think that happened, you know? So yeah. I don't think you can sugarcoat the fact that, yeah, you can label that a massacre.
Oh, 100%. 100%. It's just, it's one of those things that always comes up. Like I call it the Elaine Massacre. I call it the Fort Pillow Massacre, right? But like, there seems to be some refutation of how that is presented sometimes in the Lost Cause mythology. But regardless, what I really enjoyed is with both these films is they do get you thinking more so about participants in this institution that are outside of the normal model of, hey, well, this might have been a runaway who is now fighting in the military, who's now fighting for the Union. They were a runaway slave and now they're fighting for the Union. Or they may have been a free person who volunteered, or they may have been a free person who was kidnapped. And like, you know, I think that these all this shine a light on scenarios that are probably whole books have been written about that we just haven't read yet, right? But that's one thing. It's like, it's really got me thinking about like two or three new things with slavery and with racial relations and abolition that, you know, I will be expanding upon moving forward.
Right. I think another good thing that these movies do bring too, in comparison with some of the other examples that we've seen in this series, is that these characters don't necessarily come across as characters either. They're not certain just embodiments of how people perceived slaves to be. They seem like legitimate people. And I think that that really, really helps with the authenticity of everything.
You know, one of the like main changes they made in 12 Years a Slave from the book is that whenever he, like his first master, who's played by Benedict Cumberbatch, in the book, like Solomon Northrup was really liked him, respected him, thought he was a good person, had no ill feelings towards him. And obviously in the movie, they present that much differently. Like he's seems like a good person, but also, they don't let him get away with, you know, being a slave owner. Like you can be a good person, but are you really a good person if you own people and don't, you know, try to do anything to stop that. So I thought that was really interesting. And that's actually a change that I agree with them making. It was somewhat controversial when the film came out. I think it was mainly some white people were butthurt that the one white person in the book that was likable was presented as being more morally gray character. But I actually think like that's, you know, kind of putting on modern lenses and viewing a situation from the past, but viewing it in a way that to me is more accurate to how we should be viewing it.
Man, each plantation, Benedict Cumberbatch, I can't remember what his, what that guy's name was, but and then Epps.
Ford? Wasn't that? I want to say that I remember reading somewhere that he was responsible for founding one of the oldest congregations or something like that in Louisiana.
Wow.
And right. I mean, that ties into with the, I mean, there's this running theme too throughout the film. And I mean, it's probably present in the book too about slavery and Christianity and how, you know, if you're a Christian, how can you, justify owning slaves or even allowing slavery, the system to exist.
I did like how they played on that because they, like with Epps, it's like, hey, you see here where it says this, that's me, I'm this person in this story, that's you. But if you take a look at Christianity making inroads into the institution, via and beyond the Second Great Awakening, you know, that's, you see them picking up on the Exodus story and other stories too, but like about, hey, you see over here we have the deliverance from bondage, right? This whole story, this is going to be what we talk about today. Like, see, that's us. But you had this repurposing or interpretation that's always fascinating me. So there was a lot of familiarities when you move from plantation to plantation. One of the most disturbing with the first plantation was that he, you know, brought up the fact that, hey, you know, I'm a free person. Can you work with me? And it's like, absolutely not. You know, like, it's like basically that was probably a common occurrence. That's what I'm going to do after this is go and find, you know, half a dozen scenarios of things like this, where it's like, what can I add to my lectures about free people being kidnapped, other than just from like the Gettysburg sidebar in that, you know, like we talked about that in the past, but it's definitely something I want to expand upon. And I realized about 30 minutes into him being on Epps' plantation that was really Magneto from X-Men.
Yeah. It took you 30 minutes to realize.
Like, I was like, man, what? Where have I seen this guy? Like, it really, I was like, I was pulling for it for a second, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know why I didn't piece it together sooner. It was kind of
something that I found really funny is that, you know, this movie was made by like a British filmmaker and a majority of the cast is British or Irish, and then you got, you know, Brad Pitt to represent America. But to me it's interesting that, you know, all these Europeans came together to present what is a, you know, American story and has its roots in America. So I don't know. There's not much commentary on that. I just found it really interesting.
I found it also interesting that Brad Pitt was one of the producers. I think there were three producers.
I found that interesting too, because I wondered if he was like, I'll be in it, but I would like to play the only good white person.
Yes, that's funny.
Now, his character was supposed to be from Canada, right? Wasn't that?
Yes.
Even though his accent sounded like he was dangerously going to slip into Lieutenant Aldo Raine from Inglourious Basterds, like that was going to happen. But no. I mean, he was fine. He was great. So,
yeah, that was an exciting cameo for sure, man. But that You know, it was the first plantation was an emotional roller coaster because of that Tibbetts character, right? Like it was, but it was less just the how sadistic that Epps was. That is really, oh man, that was just a disturbing, that the whole ending sequence, that last 15 seconds where he has her him beat what's her name, Pats. That was terrible. That was really, man, that was super intense. What did you guys think about that scene?
And it was a long take too. Like they didn't cut. It went on for like at least 5 minutes without any cuts. I mean, it's like a great scene for the movie, but yeah, that's just hard to watch. To me, this 12 Years a Slave, it's a great movie. I think everyone should watch it, but it's not a movie that I like to rewatch. I actually hadn't seen it since it had come out back in 2013. And I'm good, you know, another few years before I watch it again, because it's painful to watch.
Right. Well, I mean, I think both 12 Years a Slave and I think Glory, I think both of these films benefit from the fact that they are pretty realistic in their depictions. Specifically, I mean, very visceral, right? Like that scene we're describing here. Like, I mean, it gets to you, you know? And like with Glory, the battle sequences are so well done, I think, in it, that it makes you feel like you're there. And I feel like 12 Years a Slave, right, is the same way. It makes you feel like you're there. Like Julie and I were talking earlier about some criticisms about some of like the more like nature shots and stuff that are in 12 Years a Slave.
Okay, and let's hear it.
I really think that it puts you there. It really puts you into that atmosphere, into that era. And it makes you feel that, yeah, you're there, you're seeing this. And I like that immersion, that kind of experience like that. I think that really benefits this, that ambience that you get from that. Like that, I mean, yeah, the scene where, right, Pats is being whipped, right? And it's like, you hear the whip, but you also hear like the things like the locusts in the background and stuff like that. And it's disturbing.
Lots of insects. Lots of insects.
Yeah. You know, right. So it's weird.
European like filmmakers, British filmmakers, they really captured the South. I was like, yes, it sounds like this. They made it look, you know, sweltering and the weather conditions. But there's also, you know, beautiful nature. Like they did a great job presenting this American story. And I agree, like, yeah, I could see the criticisms of the lingering on the scenery, but I think it adds to the movie and creates a lot of atmosphere.
Right. And it definitely highlights this kind of South as being a paradise, but yet hell at the same time, or at least it's paradise for some folks, but for these other folks, it isn't. And I think that's an interesting point. That's really driven by that kind of cinematography and filmmaking like that. I think that really adds to that.
Yeah, you know, but both films in different ways, but I thought painted, and why I think getting some other case studies will be helpful in bigger picture thinking, but they both create sort of a... a dynamic view about race relations outside of the South, right? So in Glory, for example, you have the Irish guy, right? The drill sergeant. He's a super racist piece of shit to the soldiers, but it's almost excused because like, there's this like, this sort of weird racial dynamic about how Irish, like if you know anything about nativism, just think Gangs of New York. I don't know if that's one we've ever talked about doing, but like piecing that together, it's like, okay, yeah, who people were horrible to the Irish. The Irish were drafted like crazy to fight in the Civil War also. And then you have this guy who's drilling black soldiers. It's like, but I just felt like there were also a lot of scenes where the soldiers in Glory, where they would be getting banter from either civilians or other Union soldiers early on in the film, like first hour, where it was like racial slurs and bantering and things like that, where you, I think sometimes like on an elementary level, back to the Lost Cause, you look at race relations, you're like, oh, well, in the North, things are great, right? Whereas it's like, no, actually, people in the North were conspiring to kidnap people, right? In the case of 12 Years a Slave. And also, it was just a fight for people who were free, who wanted to volunteer to fight for the Union, to be able to get guns, to be able to get a uniform, shoes, then to do anything other than manual labor. But it's like when you put that into context, the armed forces are not integrated until what is it, 48?
Yeah, right. Until after the end of the Second World War, right.
So that's an interesting thread to follow through on, you know, it's, but that's something I kept thinking watching both films, is how it does create a more dynamic picture for outside of the South. Some things that we can, I think, investigate more on and learn from.
Right. Right. I think, yeah, that's true. I think that's interesting. With 12 Years a Slave, I think one of the things that's fascinating, and maybe this is just due to time travel, things like that, is sort of the hard divide I feel like there is between North and South, even though the film is supposed to be set in like the 1840s, right? Isn't that when it's, yeah, or it starts in the 1840s, right? Because it's like, and like I said, it might be just due to geography too, but, you know, whenever Solomon Northrup disappears, it's not like really anybody goes looking for him, you know. But like I said, that might be due to geography, because I mean, the story starts in Sarasota, New York, and he's shipped all the way down to Louisiana, so, you know, that might have something to do with it. But I felt that was kind of interesting. And yeah, in Glory, oh, go ahead, Jules.
Something in the book that they left out of the film is that whenever he is kidnapped, he is able to get a letter out, I think it's through a sailor when he's on that ship, to his family to let them know he was taken, but they didn't know where he was going to end up, and he didn't know where he was going to end up at the time. So his family was aware that he was somewhere south, but with the geography, I mean, where do you even start if you're looking for a black slave? Like, and you are right, you know, that it does bring up the divide between North and South, and how there was a divide, and what do you do in that situation? But yeah, the movie leaves out that his family knew he was somewhere South and was still alive and had been sold into slavery.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I just think it's interesting that, right, the early scenes in the movie in Sarasota, right, I mean, he's treated pretty much just like a white person would be. And I mean, I think that's fascinating for the 1840s. I mean, even though, right, we are in New York, but, you know, that was just something that I noted. But going on to Glory with that, I think what's fascinating about Glory is that the Confederate Army really doesn't become like antagonists in the film until the end of the movie. Up until that point, the racism, the things they're fighting against, right, are from their fellow troops, officers, bureaucracy, you know, that type of situation. And I think that's interesting, right? They're supposed to be fighting a war against a great enemy, but it's all around them pretty much, the racism is. So.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, now I'm thinking of it, you don't really see Confederate soldiers unless it's a battle scene.
Right.
And even then, like, it doesn't really, the focus is never really on the Confederacy. It is more on fighting racism within their own troops and within the Northern political system as well.
Right.
So, that, I mean, that's a little depressing, but once again, right, like, historically accurate, it doesn't paint it as, you know, I mean, obviously the North was a lot better place to be if you were black, but it doesn't, you know, once again, nostalgia, rose-colored glasses, like this was the best place to be. It does show that, you know, they were still fighting racism from every corner.
Right, and you were also reaching a point in the war too where maybe certain people were blaming African Americans for being the cause of the war at this point. So people are dying on your account. So that helps fuel some of this.
They mention that in Glory, don't they? About after Antietam, right? They're like, oh, Lincoln was planning on doing this. He was just waiting on a big win, which Antietam being more, I believe, a strategic draw, right? Yeah. But I thought that was interesting to interject. I also would like to go, I have no reason to refute it, but I would like to read further on the primary source letters that are being read and narrated in Glory. I'm sure that I think it even said where the collection's at, what museum it's at. I thought I saw somewhere on the film, but what did you guys, this is kind of a superficial point, but I really was, I was pleased with the casting in 12 Years a Slave. What did you think about the casting in Glory?
It's good. I really like the casting. Our dad makes fun of Matthew Broderick in this film all the time. I actually thought he was pretty good. I would say this is probably his second best performance, first being Ferris Bueller, but like I feel like he does a good job. I don't think, you know, Robert Goldshaw, the thing I like is that he's not portrayed as like this guy who knew everything what he's doing. And, you know, to bring up like a really important topic, Glory can be viewed as a white savior film. I think for the most part, they do a good job handling that, and that, like, you know, it's also about Robert Gould Shaw. It's about him learning how to lead a group of people. And I feel like they do enough of like him working with them and making him more of an ally than like he saved all of them. I don't really think it has that attitude. And I think a lot of that is because Matthew Broderick like brings a lot of, I guess, just he seems like a real person and not this hero, which is in direct contrast to something like Gettysburg, where all the generals are presented as being, you know, when gods and generals, they're presented as being gods and these great men. And Matthew Broderick just played him like a real person trying to figure out how to lead a people. And so, yeah, I like that. And then of course, you know, you got Morgan Freeman, Denzel Washington, that's one of his best performances. I always say he won that Oscar purely on the whipping scene. Oh. He had that amazing single tear that fell. So yeah, both of those movies that we watched, the cast is just phenomenal.
Right. I agree with that sentiment completely. And I would say that to me, the most interesting characters in Glory aren't Shaw. It's the members of the 54th Massachusetts. I think they're the interesting characters of it. And yeah, Denzel Washington totally deserved that Academy Award for that was Best Supporting Actor. I think he won that. Yeah. So there's that. And right, I mean, the whipping scene is really intense, but also, I mean, when he has that sort of aside with Matthew Broderick there, where he says, you know, I'm not fighting this war for you, sir. You know, I think that, you know, that's powerful. And it's true, you know, everybody was sort of fighting for their own reasons.
Yes.
Is so good in this. Like every scene he was in, like I was watching him, even scenes where he's in the background, like I'm watching Denzel to see what he's doing. Like, and you know, like this is early in his career, but he was somewhat established, but I feel like this, the Glory like made him a star.
Yeah. Oh man, I was reminiscing on other good Matthew Broderick films. Lady Hawk, got to get an honorable mention there, and War Games.
War Games, yeah.
Ferris Bueller. So like, you know, I'm just honestly, it's another like anytime I'm gonna go watch more Matthew Broderick films after this. Ones that I might not have seen, because really those, like you mentioned, Ferris Bueller, and then Glory, of course, and then the two I just mentioned. Like that's. Those are my top films for him, honestly. What he was in that rendition of The Producers when we were in high school, but I don't even really remember a lot of his other works. What about you guys?
Yeah, mentioned Inspector Gadget.
Oh yeah. Oh man.
It was not good. But, you know, something like, too, like, I think he was well cast for this. Because what, Shaw's like in his early 20s, right?
I think he was 25 when he.
Okay, mid 20s. Yeah. And I think Matthew Broderick was like 29, 30s when he played the part. But, you know, that's another difference between like stuff like Gettysburg, like the men are older. And I like, you know, that Shaw's younger. And I think Matthew Broderick had like the perfect kind of youthfulness. Where, yeah, he appears like he's green, like he doesn't know what he's doing. So yeah, I think that's, like I said, acting wise, it's his best role, but he will always be Ferris Bueller. So,
well, yeah, I mean, he's a reluctant leader. I think that's important. Also, he's shell shocked too from Manteedum, and also I think in a way he recognizes, right, that he's, I mean, or the 54th mass, that's part of history. You know, this is gonna prove a lot. So I thought he did fine. I know people criticize his acting abilities in that film, but I thought he did fine.
I really had no problem with his performance or anything. I just wonder, and it's like one of those things that you, like you said, Julie, it was early on in Denzel's career for sure. Morgan Freeman, yeah, he's big at that point, but really all my favorite Morgan Freeman movies that really come after that, right? Yeah. Like Shawshank. Anyway, it seems to be, as in the context, maybe for us, Matthew Broderick wasn't doing a whole lot while people like Denzel and Morgan Freeman were. That's what I was thinking while watching it, is like, could there have been someone else that had maybe done more in their later career, or maybe became more of a Morgan Freeman in the hearts and minds of people. But maybe we don't need that. Like, I mean, the story here was what I was most interested in. Again, these are just kind of superficial remarks, but I thought we could maybe look at different characters to bring up some talking points, like Wesley from A Princess Bride.
Okay. First of all, I love Cary Elwes. Anytime I see him in anything, like, I get excited.
Okay, Cutthroat Island. Have we seen Cutthroat Island? One of my favorites.
Gosh, wow.
I wouldn't say good.
I was like, I'm going to ask Julia if she's seen Cutthroat Island, and then she's going to probably make fun of me about it. I was like, I worked this moment of the podcast out previously.
It has its cult following, I guess, but it's not a good movie, and it is a notorious box office bomb.
Oh man. But
that's interesting to me about Cary Elwes in this film is that apparently most of his scenes were cut and he was supposed to be in it a lot more. And also apparently he did not get along with Matthew Broderick. I'm not sure why, but they didn't get along. And then the thing that I love is his accent just appears and disappears throughout the film. But I just like him. He's a likable actor, so I let it slide. But yeah, his accent's all over the place.
Yeah, he totally pulls Keanu Reeves and Bram Stoker's Dracula. It's not that bad, but where it just vanishes. It vanishes like a quarter of the way through the film. It's gone. And yeah.
Yeah, I want to know, like, if there's scenes, you know, that were cut with him, like, what more was his character supposed to add? I actually think they did a good job editing it. Like, all you need is someone to, you know, be like a moral guidance for Shaw and question what he does, but also be his friend and have some conflict there. I feel like they get that out of his character. So yeah, I kind of wonder, like, what exactly was cut and what more was there to do with this character?
Well, I felt like Denzel was very mean in the film. You know, like initially I was like, wow, Denzel, you're being mean to everybody. What's the problem here? But then I realized I probably would have had a way worse attitude had I been in his situation, right? That's something worth remarking on, is like, how his character was kind of abrasive early on, like all the way until the whipping scene where you realize he's looking for shoes, right? Like that was when it like I really pivoted to like, but then I started thinking about attitudes of these individual participants in within this regiment, but also again in the North, right? Is you do have these dynamics of escape slave. They say that at one point when they're marching through, they're like, yeah, we're escaped slaves and now we're going back to fight. Like there's some sort of passing remark as they're moving through, right? But I think that's a fascinating thing they're trying to paint is the different attitudes. Like each character, I think, sort of represents a different attitude that's probably widely held. It's like, and I felt like they were trying to get that across with these individual characters on all of them.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but like the Black characters are just loosely based off of real people or kind of a, you know, amalgamation of
composites.
Brian, I think you're hitting on like what they were trying to accomplish with this film by not making it, you know, each character specifically is based off of this person and this person, is that they were going for more archetypes and trying to get themes across. And in doing my research, it seems like most of the soldiers in the 54th, you know, were educated. They weren't runaway slaves. They were more like Thomas would be. But, you know, they do want to get across that there were people who were runaway slaves or, you know, had come through the Underground Railroad, however they got up to the North. And then you get that aspect of people who, you know, were from the North, who were from educated families. And you get that through Thomas, which I didn't even mention, what's his face? Andre Brower playing Thomas. I thought he's really good in the movie. And apparently this was like his first movie. Now everyone knows him from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where he does a comedic role, but he's a good dramatic actor. I think the goal is to get all these different stories across. I do think it leaves it open if they ever want to do like a mini series or something based off of the 54th to kind of delve more into who the actual soldiers were and, you know, the real stories. But for the purpose of the movie, like that's something I'll let slide. Historical accuracy, I think they were more getting across ideas, and I think that worked really well for the film.
Well, and I felt like that was a shared trait really with both films. And I realized that 12 Years a Slave, and they're really, they both have the components of the firsthand account, obviously. But then how much of that do we lose when we go to film, right? But then I do feel like that's where both individual films did a great job having sort of these composite representations. Like, for example, this is super small, but I've been fascinated. This is what Dr. Jones's book is going to be about. Basically, slaves' interaction with uncultivated space, right? So you remember when Platt is going to town, right? He cuts off the main path and goes through the woods, and then he comes up on different things. But it makes a point to show that. And I mean, somebody that Thurman and I both know, Dr. Kelly Jones, maybe I'm sure she's been on the podcast and stuff, but she wrote a whole book about just the slave relationship with uncultivated space, with basically the woods or the canebrake. Anything between the farmland and the field and the town, right? Like anything that wasn't that. So I thought that was fascinating. I felt like 12 Years a Slave did a good job bringing that in. There were so many things like that in both films that were jumping out all the time, where it's like, even if we're not getting down to individual, yes, this is the character and they were like this, we've got some primary sources. I was just very happy to see versus what we're seeing with, you know, it was a nice change of scenery versus this lost cause, tired sort of approach to telling this story. It really, I think that we need all of it. I think we need to know about the lost cause myth, and we need to see these other contrary things and create a really big picture. That's I really enjoyed both of them. They were downer films, so for sure.
I think Glory to me is uplifting, even though it is a downer. And also, I'll add too, like, the name of the film is Glory. And I feel like, talking about these other Lost Cause movies, which glorify war and glorify the Confederacy, Glory to me is like, this is where, like, if you're going to try to find glory in all of Civil War, like, this is where it should be. These people coming together, fighting for this common cause to free slaves, to get rid of slavery in America. That is the true glory. And in my opinion, Glory is the best movie about the Civil War. And once again, it's something that, like, everyone should watch. I feel like we were lucky, me and Thurman, we watched as kids. I want to say I was like 8 or 9 when I was watching Glory. But yeah, people should watch this, and they should watch 12 Years a Slave instead of watching things like Gone with the Wind or even Gettysburg.
Right. I guess you could even make the argument too that Glory, in a way, is kind of an anti-war film too. And I say that because if you compare it to our other Lost Cause films, such as Gods and Generals or Gettysburg, Glory in no way glorifies the battlefield, right? It's more about the people. It's not about the events themselves. It's about the causes they fight for, the reasons they fight for, the legacy that they wish to hand down to others. It's not about, right, meeting up at this specific place in Pennsylvania or Fredericksburg or wherever else out there. And so I think you could make that, you could say that, you can make that argument. But right, they're all like Glory is right. I agree. Glory, I think, is the best Civil War film made. I mean, set during the actual Civil War. I think that's true. And one of the main issues that infuriates me about the Lost Cause myth is how, right, it tends to sideline these stories. Nearly 200,000 Black Americans fought for the Union during the Civil War. And nearly 20% of those actually were killed, or they died, in battle. To just sort of act like that never happened and instead make the Civil War essentially a white man's war, I think is egregious and ridiculous. And that is one of my major gripes with the Lost Cause myth, because the Black Americans, they didn't have to fight, but they wanted to fight.
Yeah, and so I think about this a lot, Thurman. Like, what can we do to balance things out more as historians, right? Because just looking back at even when I took U.S. History 1, it's like there is not enough time being spent on rounding these things out, right? And is it being done to save time? Are we just in an era where we're starting to see the importance of telling the story and basically filling in the blanks of things that you hear about? But I think about that all the time. It's like, well, they can't get that till college. You know, that's when they start hearing this perspective. Like, so it's an age thing. Right. We don't have enough time in the semester, or you'll get that in the upper level course. Or it's like there's always another level, which is also associated with time. And it's like, yeah, you can go out and do the work yourself. But I mean, I really literally work with a room full of students that will not read. Right. It's a racket because the textbook industry, I can't get an audiobook version of hardly any of the books I use. I'm switching from the books that were on syllabus when I started teaching there for that reason, just because more students are these days listening to an audiobook. But I do want there to be, and I'm glad we have kind of a sidebar, and I would like to do Free State of Jones is an after the show at some point. It doesn't have to be, but it would be another great, like, this is outside of the norm. really the picture looks like this. You'd have to find as many cases as you want. And I think that's when, as a historian, it's like, well, we got to save time here. But that's also where I can assign films like, or books, or add to my course syllabus, 12 Years a Slave, Glory. I have every one of my classes do a film review every semester, just like something like what we're doing right now, asking these questions. I asked some questions for them, but just get them thinking about it, because there are definitely things that I thought about watching both of these films. And I had seen Glory when I was younger, like you guys. I mean, it came on TNT all the time. Gettysburg, Andersonville.
Andersonville is also a really good movie.
I mean, it really is. I would be excited to do one over Andersonville. I really do enjoy all of these Civil War films that we're mentioning. But as I understand it too, Free State of Jones is very well researched. They had a Harvard historian on staff, but also they collaborated with the guy's family a lot. And Matthew McConaughey was apparently involved, like Brad Pitt was in 12 Years a Slave. Like he wanted to be involved. He wanted to make it happen, because like what we're talking, these are the stories that have to be told. These are the stories I have to tell in my U.S. History 1 class, right? Like I've got to work this in more than when I had U.S. History 1. And I think that a lot of it's just for saving time. But anyway.
With saying that, like, your students won't read or don't want to read, do you think that makes, like, movies even more important in, like, getting history correct and getting these stories out there?
Very much so. And that's what the theme of when I do assignments like these is. It's like, what did we lose historically here, right? Because most films, like Free State of Jones, don't have a credentialed historian or staff of historians that are consulting with the film, right? That's why I think you lose, you do lose out on some of that for cinematic value sometimes. All of these choices are made, but that's why I like doing that. And I will always try and assign a documentary. Like this is crazy. Like maybe my first semester teaching full-time U.S. History 1, I was like, so guys, you know, Ken Burns, legendary documentary filmmaker, we're going to be watching Thomas Jefferson by Ken Burns. And they're like, who's Ken Burns?
Oh, no.
And I was like, guys, I was texting Jeff Woods, who's like my history mentor coming up, department head, and was senior seminar. And I'm like, they have it. He's like, you got to tell them about Ken Burns. But it was... that's what I enjoy. It's like, so now pretty much every block I'm like, can I work a Ken Burns documentary in here as a potential assignment? So I'll do like a documentary film review, because like you get that's a whole chapter in the book, Thomas Jefferson. If they'll watch Ken Burns, Thomas Jefferson, and attend one or two of my lectures, we can get through unit 3 together, guys. We'll do it. All right. But it is, I have to think of creative digital ways to bring them in. And that's what I love about films, and why I wanted to like spin off on the podcast and do stuff like this, is because a lot of times it does convolute and it muddies the waters, but I do feel like there's a lot to learn. Like, we'll think critically and ask questions and look at characters. And oh man, I want to research a whole lot of stuff. As it comes up and after we do this podcast, and that'll be too, like what I'm excited about. We'll link back and do some side blogs on these topics that come up that I expand on and link the podcast back. And it'll be cool blog topics to start spinning off for sure. So any other comments on either of those two films?
I'd like to say, I mean, if we're talking Lost Cause again, 12 Years a Slave, you know, highlights this idea that slavery was an issue back in the 1840s. You didn't even need the compromise of 1850 with the Fugitive Slave Act in order to have people trying to drag folks back south into slavery. You know, you didn't even have to have that then.
That's a great point.
You know, that's what I mean. That's what's so ridiculous about the Lost Cause mythos is that by regulating the story to either be about a bunch of white guys fighting the Civil War, that's like the only conflict that happened, and it's all about states' rights, then yeah, you're completely exercising a whole history that exists. You're totally burying it. You're making it, yeah, into what is a white man's conflict, and it wasn't. It was that there were so many different people involved in this, and the Lost Cause myth just, hey, it's terrible.
Yeah, we talked about too, like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, like influencing history books and schools and putting up pictures of Confederate generals and schoolhouses and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, now, you know, like I said, we're, I guess, lucky that TNT showed Glory so much and that we were aware of who the 54th were and what they did. And because, you know, like we didn't get that in history classes. If you were lucky, like you may get a paragraph. I think I remember a paragraph in like my AP history textbook about like Blacks being enlisted to fight in the Civil War. But yeah, otherwise it's all about Robert E. Lee. You get stuff about Stonewall Jackson, who, you know, I hate because I hate Guts and Generals.
Dipping lemonade on a porch.
Yeah, movie was awful.
I recently watched Tombstone, and General Pickett / Stonewall Jackson was also in Tombstone. So
but that's a good movie.
It's a great movie. I love Tombstone. Okay, so here would be a cool future podcast. Tombstone and Wyatt Earp, a comparison. They came out 1 year apart, right? Kevin Costner versus Kurt Russell. I like both of them, but I like Tombstone more.
I've never watched Wyatt Earp. Specifically because Tombstone was great and it wasn't like they were going to be better than that. So what's the point? They don't have Val Kilmer. That's Doc Holliday. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Great stuff. So what are some future episodes we want to do around the Civil War series? Like, I know Thurman's got some ideas. He brought up in the past Django Unchained's one that stands out to me, but what are you guys thinking?
Well, I thought we were gonna face off we were gonna do Django and Outlaw Josie Wales. I thought those were gonna be that was gonna be a matchup. I know we were gonna go into, I think, Ken Burns' The Civil War, the documentary, at some point. We were gonna do that just so, you know, we could all beat up on Shelby Foote, the historian from that.
Yeah, I was telling
God rest his soul. I mean, he passed away a long time ago, but you know, still.
Yeah,
that's your legacy, bro.
Tom McCool about he's the other historian at UACCM. We were talking about him a little bit, and he was like, "Oh yeah, 100%, right?" But yeah, that's when that's importance to maybe do you think we'll ever see an? We can talk about this on a future podcast. Do you think we'll ever see an update on some of Ken Burns stuff for these reasons?
Well, I know that Ken Burns himself has gone on record saying that he, you know, would like to go back maybe at some point and redo some portions, add some new stuff in, mainly because of the Lost Cause myth, because I mean, it is present, it is there, and I think he recognizes, and I don't know, maybe I think at the time he was actually trying to be unbiased, but the myth, man, it's so woven into everything that it's kind of hard to separate. And when you got Shelby Foote on there talking like 2.5 hours more than anybody else on there, of course you're going to get that in there. So yeah.
Were we talking at any point about the good, the bad, and the ugly?
I mean, you're right. It is set during the Civil War, and I'm trying to think of where that, you know, works into the Lost Cause, how that, I mean, I don't
know, it is that standing out. Maybe I was thinking Outlaw Josie Wales, though.
Honestly. Right.
But yeah, so we'll plan on some of those. And then we're gonna have another Star Wars showdown. All of that stuff I was messaging about, I think would be killer podcasts. Like,
what are we gonna start with is the question.
Well, I think since Josh is not here, that we should take liberties in this podcast and decide for him. I mean,
he said
that I am a cynic.
So, so I liked what Thurman was saying. I think we could do some catch-alls, but I also, I like Rogue One and Solo together. I like Clone Wars and Solo together. I like Clone Wars by itself. I mean, I think we could take any approach and stretch it out on, like, honestly, like what we're doing with the Civil War series, we could probably make a Star Wars series of podcasts.
So I like the idea of Rogue One and Solo together because one's well made and the other's not. And then I like Clone Wars. After watching it, I feel like it's best to compare Clone Wars to the prequels because so much of it involves what happens in the prequels. It's happening, you know, alongside parts of it. So not that I'm wanting to go watch the prequels, but it is the most related to it.
So here's one thing I've been thinking about that's definitive for me is that, like, Rogue One and Solo and Mandalorian, which I think is what it was, maybe the packaging Thurman was talking about, are much more what I want from the franchise and what we got with the new trilogy, right? Like, I feel like you could maybe just turn the new trilogy and the prequels all into one film. And then it's like, hey, we had a bunch of single films and then we had the original trilogy, right? Like, they're doing that with, they're releasing another rendition, which they've done Godfather 1 and 2 together, right? Like a telling of it all in one film, right? Well, they're redoing the third film now, by the way, right? They're doing some special telling on it. Right, but I've thought about that several times. I'm like, really? You could have took out Coruscant, Jar Jar Binks, and a whole bunch of other stuff from the prequels and made it one, like, solid 3-hour film, you know, recast Hayden Christensen, who's going to be coming back, apparently, in the Kenobi series they're doing on Disney+. Anyway, we got to prepare for all that. We know it's coming, and we got to be prepared to talk about it by doing this other stuff. So I'm down for whatever, but I really do. I want to watch the Clone Wars, and that's my biggest area of interest because I've never seen it. So
yeah, well, it's 7 seasons, so it may take you a little bit.
How long are the episodes? Are they like 30 or 40 minutes?
Yeah, they're like 20 to 30 minutes.
That's what's so great about Mandalorian is that, like, I think the longest episode's is like 48 minutes or something like that. So yeah. Okay, so we also should be working towards phase 2 of the Marvel movies, I feel like, right?
That's where we left off, but okay. I'm wondering when Black Widow is ever going to come out.
Yeah, see, so that's something else, which, you know, Josh is weird about how he shows his kids the films and stuff, like, I don't know. These are all these things we're going to think about. Like, am I going to show my kids the original trilogy and then the prequels and then the new trilogy? Like, how's that going to go down? What are we going to do? What are you going to do for Luna?
I'm not even sure at this point. I just pretty much want to avoid, if it's Star Wars, I want to avoid pretty much Last Jedi, Rise of Skywalker, just because they're so bad.
And I just rewatched all of them, right? Like,
I'm up to
Rise of Skywalker. Yeah, it's, again, it could have, I don't know, I just, if I could have the new trilogy differently, I would, but at least I am finding satisfaction in things like Solo, Rogue One, Mandalorian, and I do want to round out and finish things I haven't watched yet, like Clone Wars. Have you seen Rebels yet, Julie?
No, I haven't watched it.
That could be a good future one, but that's more more present stuff. I guess Rebels is still on. Are they still making new episodes of that?
I have no idea.
I don't know. I just think, okay, so, oh, man, the Book of Boba Fett, that's going to be insane, right?
I'm stoked. I started yelling and clapping at the end of The Mandalorian.
Yes, yes.
Well, I mean, after years of just being insulted, I mean, they had him ate by the Sarlacc, and then they make him into a clone of Jango, and he's not a true Mandalorian. You don't even know he's alive. Just bring him back, you know, that was cool. That was really cool. So thank you, writers, you know.
Yeah, and
it was live all along.
Like Bib Fortuna at the very end, I was just like, oh wow. I want more of that's the sort of continuity. Like Josh and I, we text each other often about his points of view concerning the Star Wars universe. But that's the sort of continuity I want, right? Not the continuity that that was attempted in the prequels and the new trilogy, but I feel like we are getting that. And then, you know, at the same time, though, let's not forget that everything we've talked about, Palpatine's the bad guy, and that's stupid, okay? Doesn't matter what Star Wars thing we talked about, Palpatine's the bad guy. We gotta get away from that. Excited about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can have a ton of discussion on what's canon and non-canon in the Star Wars universe, because that was one of the biggest complaints with like making Palpatine the villain again, is that there's so many other villains that Disney just threw out when they made the expanded universe non-canon. Yeah. But then like, I guess villains were brought in, because I haven't watched Rebels, but apparently one of the expanded universe villains is in Rebels. So Star Wars universe is a mess. Do I like it? Yeah. Is a messy, yeah.
I was telling Thurman this while showing him my action figure collection in the studio the other day. Shadows of the Empire, I would love to see them do something with that. Like because that would be like a prequel book of Boba Fett, because that's the from Cloud City until Jabba's Palace. That's literally the little side quest that takes place in between there. And there's a great villain with Shizor. He's the bad guy, he's green dude. And I'm excited to see more about Thrawn and the tie-in with that, for sure.
Yeah. Wait, when are we watching the holiday special?
I mean, at any time. I mean, did you guys watch it over the holidays? Is the real question. I think it's on Disney Plus, isn't it?
Is it?
I think that's something. I think that's Lego.
Oh, yeah, the new Lego one.
I did see that.
Yeah, you probably will have to go to YouTube in order to find the original 1978, right? Isn't that or was it 79? All right, yeah. Yeah, you'll probably have to go to YouTube to find that. You know, the holiday specials that George Lucas famously said that he wished he could have tracked down every VHS copy of and destroyed with a hammer.
That's... Well, also, can sidebar remark on that is, it, like, when it, was that duck film, that crazy duck film that George Lucas did after Star Wars?
Oh, Howard the Duck? Is that what we're talking about now? Wow, wasn't that was like 485.
Yeah, there's like right after Return of the Jedi. How disturbing. Yeah. There's Marty McFly's mom hooks up with the duck.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Anyway. How did we go from talking about the Lost Cause to Howard the Duck?
This was housekeeping. This is what we do before before and after the lecture. This is the banter.
It's a show within a show. after the show.
But yeah, so wait, some future.
Which is a better movie, Gods in General or Howard?
See, full circle. We did it.
I would pick Howard the Duck, honestly. It's shorter.
You know, I don't know. If Howard the Duck had been on a porch sipping some lemonade, maybe. That's the only thing that was missing from
Hold on, I'll show you guys something before we wrap it up here, since we're talking Star Wars.
Oh, that's nice.
Mando.
Yeah. Did you see this one? Yeah, it's a bobblehead, but it's a pop. Somebody got it for me for Christmas. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, we have to pick what we're starting with, though. Should we start with Solo and Rogue One, or?
What was your exact idea that you hit back with, Thurman? I would be down to do that. Were you saying Solo, Rogue One, and Mandalorian all three?
Yeah, I think that's what I was saying, because they're kind of in a way outside of the, well, or they should be. They should be outside of the Skywalker saga, even though, of course, there are ties. But, you know.
Well, we're all ready to go on that. We've all seen all three of those, so we could conceivably book that episode. And I'll be watching. I'll be watching Clone Wars in the meantime. We can pull that together in a few weeks or something. If we want to do Django next, I'd be down for that. But really, just whatever you guys are down for, I'll be watching. Focusedly watching these films, and we're finishing. Also, I thought about you, Julie. We're finishing Return of the King this evening. All right. Did all three this week in the last 3 days. It's been exciting evenings.
They're still so good. Those movies have aged so well. Classics.
I remember, like, I was thinking back when I was watching Fellowship of the Ring the other night. I remember they were doing a weird showing at Clarksville Cinema. So I ended up, like, watching part of The Last Samurai while waiting on Lord of the Rings to start or something like that, right? Like, it was a longer movie, so I had a different start time or something like that. So I ended up sitting in Tom Cruise, the Scientologist's Return of the Samurai.
That's great. Clarksville Cinema is. Did they not clean out the theater in between movies?
It was, I can't remember exactly what it was, but yeah, it was something weird with start times. But yeah, what was that film called? The Last Samurai? Is that it?
The Last Samurai? Tom Cruise? Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, that's full circle here. We're back to glory. Same director. That was Edward Zwick.
Also, would you call that a white savior movie?
Yes. Yes, actually, I would, even though, like, the production design and everything on that is really great, and Ken Watanabe is great in that film. Yeah, it is actually kind of like, I don't know why they had to have Tom Cruise running around in samurai armor. I don't know. There's no point. Just make him an observer, you know? Right?
Oh, and he knew General Custer. Like, they went over the top with it in a couple of, I mean, I do have a soft spot for it because of martial arts, right? Obviously.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like a bad film per se, but yeah, that thread, that white savior thread, is all throughout that. Also, music by Hans Zimmer, who did the music for 12 Years a Slave, which was really good.
And I will say, Last Samurai's music is really good. 12 Years a Slave sounds like it's from Zimmer's, like, scraps. Like, I swear I've heard it, like, in all of his movies.
I thought it was fine, you know? I thought it was okay. I recognized it immediately. I was like, yeah, that's Hans Zimmer. I knew it. But, I mean, we're talking about Glory, and nobody even mentioned the score to that, the James Horner score, which helps, I think, elevate certain scenes in that film to, like,
for sure.
Greatness. Yeah.
That score, like, just, it makes me cry. Like, it's so beautiful.
I did. I no exaggeration. I did kind of like, not like Denzel, like the tear didn't fall. Okay. But like five times I teared up for sure. Five times. I counted. I was like, oh man. And then I only really teared up and cried a real tear in 12 Years a Slave once. So.
Yeah. Okay. So Glory, the parade scene that they have, the score over that is incredible. Like, I mean, that's like one of those things where it's not sad, but yet it is in a way, because everybody is, you know, they're so jubilant and happy. And then, of course, like that final sequence when they're about to charge Fort Wagner, which, technical detail, actually in real life, the beach was reversed. They were actually charging the other direction instead of, I don't know if that just suited better with what they were doing or whatever, but yeah, just that Matthew Broderick staring out over the ocean, you know, and it's like, you know, he knows that they're going to die, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, he hands the letters over to the journalist, right? And he's like, you know, remember what you see here. If this man should fall, who will take the flag? Thomas stepped forward. I will. You know, and it's like, oh my God, man, you know?
Well, and I'll make this remark too, like how it's just kind of like, not to give any spoilers, but just kind of an abrupt ending for some of our beloved characters. But like many, many things that I just feel like they're glimpsing into, it's like, well, yeah, that's it. Because I remember when I was a kid, just seeing it, and then in the end, you're like, what? What? That's it? Like, you just, that's it? There's no, like, I'm holding you and you're passing away. Like, none of that. It was just like, yeah, you're shot, and now you're no longer living. And he got shot, too, and he's not yet, and the movie's over. Like,
Right. Well, I mean, that's what I was saying. Why you could even argue that Glory, in a way, is an anti-war film, is because its depictions of the battles are far more realistic than what we see, for example, in Gettysburg or Gods and Generals, where they almost resemble paintings. This is different. You see the chaos, the complete chaos of battle, you know?
A lot of
hand-to-hand combat. People are just getting dropped left and right. There's smoke everywhere. Nobody knows exactly where they're going. You know, I mean, there's that really bad effect in Antietam where that guy's head gets blown up by a cannonball. That's kind of ridiculous. Well, I mean, the effect. I mean, that happened, of course. But, you know, it's just, yeah.
They had a hospital scene that hopped out to me as well, where he's kind of like, and you can tell he's flashing back to Antietam when there's like, I guess there's an amputation or something going on. Well, maybe that is when he is at Antietam.
Yeah, it is. Right. Yeah.
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 They definitely show like the horrors of war. And, you know, like my complaint about Gettysburg was that these guys are just kind of sauntering across the battlefield and it's all glorified and in glory, like it's madness. And they are running. You get the sense that these guys can die. Like this is not, the message seems to be war is not good, but is unfortunately sometimes necessary. And then, the final shots of like them just throwing the bodies into like a trench, and this idea like that the Confederates buried Shaw with his men, that was supposed to be like a slight against him, but his parents were like, no, like that's where he'd want to be. Don't move his body. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, no, but right. And I think that's what makes both of these films, both Glory and 12 Years a Slave, so important, is that they attack central elements that we see in the Confederate Lost Cause myth. This idea that, well, slavery was good for Black people. No, it wasn't, right? 12 Years a Slave obviously shows that that's not true, and that a lot of some of the slaves that we see in there go along with it just because they're trying to survive. You know, that's what, you know, it's not that they want to be there. It's they're just trying to make it through this horror, you know? And then, right, Glory totally undermines the idea that this war is this chivalrous gallantry, it's this great, grand experience, because it's not.
Yeah. The one thing that stood out, like in all that that end scene, is like Morgan Freeman. I think he's like, form a firing line right here, and it's like, you guys are fighting bayonets right now, like literally everywhere around. And but it's like out of necessity, we have to form a firing line because we're getting flanked over here. I really did enjoy the realism of those scenes, for sure. Like that, there's several parts of the hand-to-hand that stood out to me, that were well. And that's what I like about Little Round Top in Gettysburg, though, is the hand-to-hand, how they sort of depict those charges, or the recharge of the Confederates after that cavalry barrage early on, in the first engagement of Inglory. I thought that was really good.
But, yeah. I mean, right. I think that's the pinnacle of Gettysburg, right? Is Little Round Top or whatever. But right, to me, it's, if you compare the charge on Fort Wagner versus the defense of Little Round Top, I think that might be a very interesting parallel between the two, because you know, Little Round Top, it's victorious, right? It's kind of like, it's supposed to be inspirational and all that. And I mean, in Glory, they get cut to shreds, you know? I mean, even though they're proving, you know, that black soldiers are just as good, if not even better, than many of their white counterparts, which was a debate during that time period, you know, could black soldiers be as good as white soldiers? And obviously, yes, and in many cases, even better. So,
yeah, I did like how they did show, I guess, when they're going off to fight, they're actually getting cheered on by their fellow soldiers, which I appreciated that, because that was such a dynamic shift from how the story began, how they were telling it initially when they're first forming or before they formed. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, the charge on Fort Wagner was viewed to be a suicide attack, that there was probably no way they were going to do it, but they, you know, decided that they were going to try anyway and suffered horrendous casualties because of it, but they proved their abilities in battle. And, you know, I mean, it's anti-war too, because they have to go to those kind of lengths to prove that they are just as good as the white soldiers are. So, you know, and they shouldn't be that way.
Yeah. Man, I should just like clip this ending part we just had and swap with the Star Wars conversation.
Yeah, I realize that. I'm sorry, y'all. I just, you know.
I believe in your editing skills, Brian.
Maybe one will become an Instagram clip. And all right. But yeah, that was some great podcast banter there at the end, back full circle.
It was nice to watch really good movies, guys. Not Gods and Generals or Birth of a Nation, which is just not good.
It was. So, well, I guess I'll be in touch with you guys about future projects. And yeah, I guess we can go ahead and wrap it up. I'm going to get off here and play with this course pedal, Thurman. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right. Yeah, I am loving it, by the way. It is awesome. So many thanks. And always good to see you, Julie. Thanks for always collaborating. I appreciate you guys.
Yeah, thanks Brian. This was fun.
All right. Yep. We'll see y'all. Sign off.
All right.